comments and views expressed on The Kevin Smith Show are those of the people who make them and do not necessarily represent the views of Kevin Smith, The Kevin Smith Show, or any of its affiliates or advertisers. And welcome to the Kevin Smith Show, whoever you are, wherever you are, all around this gorgeous, gorgeous planet we call home, and sometimes we call Earth. Thanks for being here at the Kevin Smith Show. Now, for those of you who are joining us for the very, very first time this evening, welcome aboard. I'm glad you're here, and I hope you make a habit out of it. I hope you make this your home each and every night, Monday through Friday at this time. It's a good habit to get into. Lots of people have it. If you are new, you need to know that we have a free weekly newsletter. Just go over to my website. It's called, my website is kevinsmithshow.com. Just go over there, and then you'll find a button there that has K-Files e-zine on it. It's in red letters. Just click that and subscribe, and then you'll be good to go. You can unsubscribe anytime you want to. No strings attached. And most people stay with us for a long time. Most people stay with us forever. But if you decide that you want to unsubscribe, you can. It's very simple. NASA has kind of run into a tough deal. They've been trying to figure out what they were going to do about this problem of getting astronauts up to the space station and back from the space station and to get supplies up there and so forth. Because, you know, the shuttle missions to the space station, there may be one more, I don't know, but they're going to run out. And we don't have our new system built yet for transporting people up to the space station. And we had this law in place that said that we could not purchase space services from Russia. Now, that's an old law from the Cold War and so forth. And right at the moment, the only people, well, as soon as the shuttle missions end and they retire the shuttle, the only people that have a way to get anyone to and from the space station are the Russians. And we had this thing that they couldn't pay for any space services. And so there now has been some legislation passed that does allow them, allows NASA to pay the Russians for space services. In other words, for a space taxi, a way to get our astronauts up to the space station and to bring them home. That is the Soyuz space capsule. It takes Russia about 3 years to build a Soyuz spaceship, and it's a really good spaceship. It's no frills, but it's really, really dependable, and it takes them about 3 years to build it, and our current agreement ran out in 2011. So they had to do something to extend beyond that because we won't have our new system ready to go. Had they not done this, it means that now that the space station is built and ready for full science, we wouldn't have been able to be there. Now we can. My guest is Robert Morningstar. We'll be back with him after this break. Don't go away. And we are back. My guest this evening is Robert Morningstar, and I think just about all of you know who he is. He's been with us before. He is with us again tonight. Let me get some of our technical stuff done here, a few knobs turned here and there. There we go. And he is with us again tonight. He is the editor of UFO Digest, an excellent site. And we're always delighted to have him with us. Robert, welcome back to the show.
Thank you, Kevin. Good to be back.
Robert, we went through a period of time there. I'm still adjusting things. We have some new equipment here, so some of this is unavoidable. All right, the last time you were here on the show with me, we had a thing going on, and we sort of did several shows where we talked about this UFO disclosure meeting that was reported to have taken place at the United Nations building in New York City. And you talked to us about your contacts and Clay Pickering and Sean Pickering, and you put me in touch with them. And they talked with us on air about their contact and how they came about all this information. I'd just like to get an update on that, if there are updates. What's up with the UN and all of that story?
Well, you can see the quick train of events that have transpired since we broke that story, adding weight to the validity and the accuracy of what we reported in February. As far as the specifics of these ongoing meetings, I can tell you that in March and April there were four more meetings in this area. They've been dispersed to other sites in the New York area, and the preparations continue to develop how they are going to make this revelation disclosure of the UFO, and most likely 2009 is what I see. I think everything's been pushed up, and the role of historic events that we see across the world, including economic ones, I believe are all tied up with this event.
All right, you say there have been four other meetings. Do you have details of those meetings as you had of the first meeting?
Not very specific, more logistical and organizational meetings and how to put in motion the bureaucratic apparatus that's going to generate how the information is disseminated and the timetable. So that's basically what I know of that. I do know that there has been ongoing contact with that specific race of ETs, the ones who I say are more benign and human-oriented rather than others that we know of, like the Greys, the abductors, those kind of things. There is a great concern about the state of the planet on their part, and it has to do not just with world events as mankind generates them, but world events on a tectonic level involving Earth changes, and it's basically scientific observations that they're making of Earth because they believe that the Earth has become very unstable electromagnetically and geologically. The tsunami in Southeast Asia a couple of years ago is one indication of this process. And so there is great concern on their part about how mankind is driving, and through his technology, for example, the HARP experiment, we are affecting the electromagnetic field of the Earth, the Schumann resonance. And affecting electromagnetic fields also has an effect on the iron core of the Earth and tectonic forces. They are not isolated.
Now that you bring that up, let me throw this into the mix and see what you think about this. This new Large Hadron Collider over in Switzerland and France, they switched it on just to test the power up and it broke.
Right.
And it rather seriously broke, dumping tons of liquid helium into that tunnel. That certainly is not cheap. Helium is very expensive, and liquid helium even more so. And then there are, you know, there's the equipment that has to be repaired now and so forth. But the problem was that they had a problem with one of the giant magnets. Now, when they power this thing up, they are going to be using magnets generating a magnetic field more powerful than man has ever generated so far as we know.
Correct.
Is it possible, and it would seem to me that it would be, that generating a magnetic field that powerful could actually, in some way, mess with the natural magnetic field of the Earth?
That, without a doubt. Anyone can take two magnets and put north to north and south to south, and you can just play with the power of a magnet, which I do all the time. I am working on a magnetic motor. But there are very powerful magnets that you can just do this experiment. Now, if they're fluctuating magnetic fields and racing them around in a torus, that's basically a donut shape, to create the medium for these collisions to find the Higgs particle, obviously it's going to be interacting with the magnetic field of the Earth, specifically right there in Switzerland, with the great mass of the Alps involved in this. So this is very serious business. I predicted that there would be something wrong. It's really risky business. And scientists, in their conceit, believe that they can harness and control all natural forces, and I think they're getting to the threshold where they're going to find out that you can't play with nature. You can't play with nature on a global scale, and specifically on a gravitational scale. It's been my thesis for 40 years that the atomic testing that occurred in the 1950s in the United States, in Russia, the British experiments, the French experiments in the South Pacific, created tectonic waves, and tectonic waves take a much longer period to propagate. And it's my recollection that when I was a boy, most of the earthquakes that occurred in the Western Hemisphere and in South America specifically occurred way, way down toward Tierra del Fuego and Chile. And over the years in the 60s, 70s, and 80s, I saw the incidence of great earthquakes move up through South America. And by 1972, the earthquakes had started to move through Nicaragua. And I see that these waves are resonating within the Earth and displacing the magma. And as the magma is displaced or pressure is generated, the mantle can fracture and move and shift. And so it's obvious to me, at least, you know, people will contest it, but that the nuclear testing that we did, especially underground testing, created havoc in the fluid movements of the Earth, within the Earth. And that,
and really, now when you say we, you mean we all over the planet.
Everyone who detonated nuclear weapons underground.
Yeah.
Even overground. Overground, how the weather has to have been affected on a grand scale with the release of the thermal energies of hydrogen bombs in the atmosphere. All of that heat had to go somewhere. It went up into the stratosphere and the ionosphere, and as it did so, it would, of course, logically displace great masses of the natural atmosphere, creating undulations and fluctuations in the jet stream. So it's not surprising that the chaos that has been generated over by the advancement of science and technology has created a great perturbation in the natural rhythms of the Earth as they were before 1950 or 1948, when all of that really big.
Well, as editor of UFO Digest, you see a lot of articles come across your desk. And looking at all of the stuff that comes across your desk, do you see anybody addressing this Large Hadron Collider issue in terms of its magnetic field and the possibility that it could really mess with Earth's magnetic field? Are people writing about this?
Well, you'll not see that in the general media or the general scientific literature. But there have been what you would call voices in the wilderness that are not part of mainstream science and who have voiced their concern. I have been ranting against it for a long time. You know, if a man built it, Murphy's Law applies, and if something can go wrong, it will go wrong. I predicted that. I sent it through the TAP 10 group and through all the lists, UFO lists and others that I address. And lo and behold, it didn't even take a week for the first glitch to occur. And when you talk about liquid helium, you're talking about a super cold fluid.
Yeah.
Way, way down there, you know, close to absolute zero. So what the hell happened in that place and the cleanup that they're going to have to do is...
Oh, yeah, they say that it's down for at least 2 months.
I would never go near a site like that myself.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they say it's going to be down for at least 2 months, maybe more. All right, now, you live in the New York City area, and you are involved very much so in UFO news, UFO reporting. You speak at conferences. What's going on with in the New York area with UFOs? You know, we hear about UFOs all over the place, but we don't hear too much out of the New York City area.
Well, I have to say that it has to do with two things. It has to do with human perception and the canyons of New York. Most New Yorkers are city-bound, and if you don't look at the sky or can't see the sky, you're not going to see what's happening in the sky. But those of us who are fortunate enough to live near open skies and are studying the heavens, I myself have had a long series now. I call it a long series because it's a year and a half of steady observations from extremely high altitude at night of luminous craft moving in a south to north direction at thousands of miles an hour, way up, you know, at the middle of the night, and a luminous object traversing the heavens from north to south in about 15 seconds. That's quite a lot of speed. And then there's been a series of flyovers that have been so slow that I had to say to myself, my God, it looks like they're just sightseeing. The series started in 2007. The first one was around March, and it was in Riverside Park, and an object was seen crossing over the Hudson River quite serenely against the wind. I would say at about 1,500 feet, level flight from west to east, and passing directly over north-central Manhattan.
Did you see this one?
Long Island region.
Did you see this one yourself, or it was reported to
you?
Yes,
I saw this one myself.
How large was it?
Standing in Riverside Park at this site called the Soldiers and Sailors Monument.
How large was it?
I would estimate that it was about 30 feet in diameter at the distance that I was seeing it.
What shape? Was it elliptical or a cigar shape or triangle?
This is the interesting thing. It was in a sense elliptical, but as it moved through the air around it moved as if to create a distortion. Well, I took to be a distortion. Something like you would see in a mirage in the desert.
Yeah.
So its outline was not solid for the entire duration of its passage. It, at one point, it seemed to morph for the area around it. And now this is a daytime sighting. And I think that this is one of the effects that a craft has on the atmosphere that it disturbs the atmosphere, not like an airplane does, you know, blowing the air and wrapping it around the wing and distorting it in that sense, but that there is a plasma effect around UFOs, which has been described since the 50s, fuzzy edges, for example.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that that's what I saw, a demonstration of that, that phenomenon.
And how close were you to this?
I would say that I was about half a mile to three quarters of a mile from it.
You weren't very far away.
I know it very well because I've flown it for 25 years. Mm-hmm. And I know the limits, the airspace around Manhattan, the VFR corridor, as it's called. There's an area over the Hudson River over which a pilot can fly freely under VFR conditions, not in air traffic control, because I think this is the most complex air traffic control area, because we have three airports that overlap. They're TCAs. So you imagine three wedding cakes super overlapping each other and intersecting. So we have to know how to negotiate the airspaces. And below certain altitudes, generally, let's say below 1,500 feet, there are tunnels in the air through which you can fly between these airports without having to travel into the controlled airspace.
Yeah.
So I know these very well, and I can tell you that the altitude was about 1,500 feet, and that the distance was straight and level flight. You know,
mm-hmm.
Eliminating balloon. The wind was blowing the other way. This one was steady, almost as if it was on a rail.
So, and this was a daytime sighting?
Pardon me?
This was a daytime sighting?
Here's the interesting thing, okay? This was at 11 o'clock on a Saturday, and I have a habit of going to the park at that season to teach my classes at the monument. It's called the Soldiers and Sailors Monument. And about 3 weeks later, again on a Saturday, just after 11 o'clock, my student taps me on the shoulder and he says to me, "Hey, Robert, what do you think of that?" And I turned around and looked to the northeast, and I would say about 10 blocks away and hovering over West End Avenue at an altitude, I would say, that I thought then about 700 feet. Because you can use the buildings, for example, you know, you can use the buildings as measures.
Yeah.
And so we watched it, and this thing was still. It was just still. And we were wondering what it's about, and we're checking the wind, and the wind is blowing, but this thing isn't moving. And slowly it started to drift down West End Avenue, coming closer and closer and closer, until it was about almost parallel with us, and it stopped there for another few minutes, and then it just drifted and disappeared behind the buildings at about an altitude of about 700 feet. So that was, this thing looked burnished on one side and silvery on another. It was interesting. The sunlight, at 11 o'clock in the morning, you can imagine, just before noon, the angle of incidence. So the top part of it was shinier, but the lower part of it looked copper-colored or burnished bronze and just drifted.
Mm-hmm.
And now this one wasn't fuzzy at all. This one was solid state and went off.
And there was no sound?
Pardon me?
No sound?
No, all of these are perfectly silent. And now I would like to fast forward to...
Well, I'll tell you what we have to do. We're going to have to go to a break, and we'll pick up there when we come back. All right, folks, more with Robert Morningstar when we get back, and we're going to get into tonight his... observations about the ABC special that was on. A lot of you saw about UFOs. We'll be back. And we are back. My guest this evening is Robert Morningstar, and he was Robert. You were telling us about this sighting that you had as you went into the park with your class, with your
right.
students.
I'd like to tell you this is a very panoramic view of sky. I have the entire sky to the north and to the west and to the southwest to see as I'm on Manhattan Island. And this is a promontory point in New York City that is 70 feet over the water level of the Hudson River. And the terrain slopes down quickly in about 300 feet to the banks of the river. So there's a lot of open sky and beautiful scenery. It's actually a forest with promenades and playgrounds, like, you know, normal American parks. But it's unique and it's set in Manhattan. And special to me because I grew up in this neighborhood. And I've lived here over 50 years. I was a kid on this monument, clambering around in the 50s and 60s. So it's kind of home to me, and it's natural to me to be there and to teach Tai Chi on Saturdays. My Tai Chi class involves certain sports that I've developed out of the Tai Chi principles called Tai Chi sports, and they involve martial arts applied to sports. So we do the work with the legs with the soccer ball and multiple soccer balls. We play a short court soccer, which is a very intense, close proximity game for scoring. And in this I teach self-defense. I don't like my students to beat each other up and pound each other's heads like you see in karate school. So we use these objects to direct the energy. And it the velocity is great and the skill is required to evade it. The other sport that I've developed to a very high level of skill, which my medium and intermediate and advanced students learn, is double disc frisbee and triple disc frisbee. We embed them. They fit together. And when we throw the double disc frisbee, you throw one, and as it flies, if you gauge the aerodynamic forces correctly, they split. And the skill is to bring it within the range of motion of the opposing player, or the partner, really, because we're not out to get each other. We're trying to develop each other's skills. And you have to catch the two of them at the same time or sequentially. And we've developed skills to catch them two with one hand and, you know, three at a time. So I'm playing this double disc frisbee on the south side of the monument on Labor Day, Saturday at 11 o'clock, 2007. I'm facing south. My student is facing north, a very talented student I have named Svi. And he stops the play for a second, walks up to me, says, "Robert, look at that. What do you think that? What do you think of that?" And I turned around, look to the north. And here, very serenely, very beautifully, floating over the trees in a straight line, heading south, basically over the West Side Highway, is a perfect sphere. Perfect, beautiful, a pearl. And in diameter, I would say it was about 10 feet in diameter, coming over the treetops, altitude no higher than 200 feet. And it's interesting that this site where we play this sport is a monument. It has a huge 75-foot tall flagpole with an American flag while he's flying, and also the MIA, missing in action flag, flying. So I check the wind, and the wind was blowing from the west to the east, and this thing is heading south and west. And suddenly, as I'm contemplating this amazing sight, trying to gauge its speed, which I would say was about 25 miles an hour, gauging it because the highway is right over there, and most of the cars are doing 50 and 60, and there's north and south traffic. So, again, I have a measure for calculating estimated speed. Suddenly, my student says, "Hey, look, Robert, there's another one." I said, "Where?" And he then pointed over more directly to the southwest and out over the Hudson River. Holding a position was another white pearl, like the one that was moving down here. And he says to me, "Do you think they could be balloons?"
And I said, I'm sorry, he said what?
He said, "Do you think that could be a balloon?"
He
said, "Look at the wind. Look at the flag."
Yeah.
"Balloons can't move against the wind like that." And it was steady and just perfectly smooth. Then it flew by the flagpole. And then I was contemplating the one over the Hudson River at about, this one was again, 1,500 feet, 1,200 to 1,500 feet over the middle of the Hudson River, holding station is what I call it, standing perfectly still. And this one comes by and then starts to climb out, climbed up and joined, separated, I would say, by about 100 feet from the other one. And I turned to my friend and I said, see, balloons don't fly against the wind, meet up with each other, and stop in midair exactly like that. And in the time it took to say that sentence, we looked up again, and the two of them moved off perfectly in unison, climbing out into the clouds were, I would say, at about 5,000 feet. So from 1,500 feet, beginning to enter clouds, thin clouds at 1,500 feet, I said to him, hey, you have your cell phone camera. Go get it. Run to get it. So he ran over, and just in time he clicked. But by then, they were up there and passing into this very, very thin, wispy cloud. And he was able to just get a pinpoint of a white spot in the cloud that distinguished one of them because the other one had already disappeared into the cloud.
Well, you know, just a few months ago, there was a story about a UFO crash in, I believe it was Alabama. And they said that it was it looked like it was spherical, and it looked like a white pearl.
This is why I was intrigued. That was Dick Criswell who brought that information and brought it to my attention. And I was intrigued by that, and I wanted to know about this pearl because these two pearls had appeared on Labor Day, Saturday Labor Day last year, at 11:05, because we had just started our training, our workout. And on beautiful days like that and a nice wind, we like to fly the double disc frisbee. So I said to him, you know what? I think we're being watched. I think, you know, these things, out of curiosity, now what the hell are we doing here? Look, we've got two frisbees, and they're really flying saucers, and we're slinging them with this skill, and we're doing things that almost no one practices. I'm sure everyone can do it, but, you know, people don't conceive of this, of, you know, slinging frisbees one inside another, and having the skill to split them upon arrival so that they are catchable and that we do catch them. And this is how we apply the movements of Tai Chi to develop higher levels of skill without violence or...
Okay, so are you serious when you think that maybe these things were just there to observe you guys doing this, or are you sort of tongue-in-cheek with that?
Things like this do draw attention. And since they draw attention from, you know, just the ordinary human beings that are running by and biking by and people stop and watch. It's rather unusual, but really, literally, we are showing very high-level skills of being able to control the flight of rotary wing aircraft, and that's why I started playing Frisbee about 30 years ago with that idea in mind, that it's a vehicle, it's a laboratory for studying the dynamics of rotary flight. And curiously, the Frisbee arrived on Earth the same year that the Roswell crash occurred. I don't know if people know that.
No, I didn't know that.
Oh, really? 1947. In the fall of 1947, and at Yale, the home of Skull and Bones, a group of students picked up an aluminum pie plate. The pies were served in the mess hall, the lunchroom of Yale University, came from a company called the Frisbee Pie Company. And they came in these aluminum plates that were curved with the shape that we call Frisbee today. And so some genius at Yale picked it up and slung it and saw that it flew. And they started slinging these aluminum plates on the fields of Yale in the fall of 1947.
Well, that's a bit of trivia I did not know.
Oh, yeah. And then a gentleman named William Morrison in the 1950s, he saw the potential, he got the hang of it, and he realized, this is a beautiful sport, but somebody's going to get killed with an aluminum pie plate coming in at 70 miles an hour if you miss it. It's a very good teacher, a Frisbee. You know, people take it very lightly. But the Frisbee is a weapon. It's the discus. It's the modern evolution of the discus that we see in the Olympics, which, strangely enough, is shaped like a flying saucer. Which brings me, if I may, just on this tangent. All of you saw the Olympics. Did you see that crazy commercial about the Olympics in ancient Greece, and the guy comes out with the discus, and he throws it, and he clocked the Parthenon and created a chain reaction that knocks down the pillar and knocks down the facade and the frieze of the Parthenon because of the wind? I found that a very strange massage. You've heard me say that the medium is the massage. And I saw that as a very strange exercise in mass psychology, directed at the viewing public of the world, you know, whoever saw that. It was very strange to me that this discus thrown by this Greek athlete, godlike, you know, demigodlike, he slings it, and all of a sudden this disc comes down and crashes and destroys the Parthenon, which is the foundation, the cradle of Western civilization and democracy. So I see things like this, you know. I interpret the symbolism behind this massage, you know, mind control massage.
Yeah.
So I was
that
I
is
was,
strange.
The first two or three times I saw that, I said, "Oh my God, that is horrible." What it says to me is that flying saucers are out to destroy the cornerstone of Western civilization, Greco-Roman civilization.
Speaking of something that was on television, which you were, let's talk about the ABC special that so many of our audience have seen and have written me emails about. The fact is, I didn't get to see it because when it was on, I was on. And so I didn't get to see it. But I've got.
Did you see the original Peter Jennings special?
Yes, I did. Yeah, I saw the original.
And basically, I think I would say that you saw maybe half of it, or a third of it, and I actually missed the first half hour because I was taking a navigation class, and I was racing back from the boat to get here in time. I got here at about 10 o'clock, and what I missed was the Phoenix Lights section, which was excoriated. It was ripped to shreds by everyone who watched it, and it was primarily because they did not interview Governor Fife Symington. And they dissembled by using the footage of the so-called flares hovering over Phoenix at about 10 o'clock.
Mm-hmm.
They totally ignored the distinction actually between the 8 o'clock overflight of the huge, I will call it, flying wing, because it wasn't exactly triangular. Mile and a half in wingspan that covered the stars, and I spoke to Governor Fife Symington in Washington at the National Press Conference on UFOs, and he described that this thing was so big and flying so low that it blocked out the sky from horizon to horizon. Someone described it as so big that if you opened up a New York Times, which is a rather large piece of newspaper, and held it above your head, looking at the sky covering it. That's how much area was covered. My friend Vince White, a ufologist who lives in Kansas City and follows this very closely, informed me that commercial airline pilots who were flying higher than this craft at 35,000 feet started to see vast patches of city lights disappearing. And as they saw them disappearing, they couldn't understand why until they realized that there was some kind of shade object flying and shading out up.
Okay, we have to take a break. We'll be back right after this, and we'll continue with Robert Morningstar. Don't go away. Welcome back. We are privileged to have as our guest this evening Robert Morningstar, editor of UFO Digest. And we've just got into discussing this ABC special that so many of you saw. And you sent me email and talked about it, discussed it. And I really can't discuss it intelligently. I can't offer any information intelligently because I didn't get to see it. I was live on the air when it was on. But anyway, you were telling us about it, Robert, so go ahead.
Yeah. It was actually a very interesting hodgepodge of the events that were told by Peter Jennings in Seeing is Believing, with clips added from recent events since that time. And there were interesting stories. I came in when a French pilot, a gentleman who appeared, French airline pilot, who was also in Washington, told the story of encountering a huge red UFO, and he was looking at it aghast. I mean, it was, again, of such size that it makes a 747 or an Airbus look puny. So he saw this thing flying with his aircraft. It was ahead of him and flying with his aircraft, keeping pace. Then he saw it tilt up at a 45-degree angle. And just from that angle, just go straight up. And he was left, of course, flabbergasted. He had no explanation in his experience of aviation, in years of aviation, to become a pilot, I believe it was Air France, to explain this experience. So that's where I came into it, and I thought that was pretty well done. You know, you saw his the wonder that still remains with him so many years after the event. Then there was going back and forth, the skeptics, the debunkers, a little back and forth. Seth Shostak making his pitch for the radio telescopes, and that's the only way we're going to find aliens, because we're going to pick up their radio transmissions.
Listen, I could be wrong about this. I mean, really, I don't know that I'm correct on this, but it is my opinion that we're never going to pick up radio signals from these guys, because radio would be far too primitive and slow for their spaceships.
Exactly. It's also like hunting intentionally in the wrong place. You know what I mean? It's a distraction. They're hunting in the wrong place, and they're distracting and putting public attention in this region of radio telescopy. And the fact is, the UFOs are here, locally, in our solar system, and it's part of the big machine of the cover-up and the blinders, both physical and psychological blinders that they have imposed on the public.
Well, let me tell you, I read an email that Seth Shostak posted to a news group where he was pretty hot about people saying that he doesn't think there's extraterrestrial life out there.
Why is he looking for a signal?
Well, he was defending his position, and you know, he said in this, I'll call it an article. It was kind of a letter, and he was pretty hot about people blasting him and saying that he's just a debunker. And he said, look, you know, I'm looking for the real thing.
I call him a skeptic. There is a distinction.
Okay. Yeah, well, but look, if you're going to be a good investigator, some people use the word skeptic. If you're going to be a good investigator, you have to be able to say, I don't believe and I don't disbelieve. I'm neutral here. Let's investigate. Now, that might, to some people, be, they may think that's a skeptic. But an actual skeptic is, in my opinion, someone who is already over on the minus side. They're already over there saying, I don't believe. I disbelieve. Now, maybe I'm not defining that correctly, but to me, that's what the word skeptic means. I think an investigator has to just be neutral and say, let's see.
It's good to be somewhat skeptical, but not be a skeptic. That's a paradox. But I make the distinction between a debunker, who is a person who does understand that the phenomenon is real, valid, and witnessed around the world, millions of people, but is out there on a mission to suppress that information. It's a person who knows better but is willing to stand there and take pot shots at ufology and play the distractor and the laughing clown like Bill Nye did on Larry King.
Yeah, but you know, even those guys, I mean, they're irritating, but they serve a good purpose. And the purpose is it keeps people on their toes and holds their feet to the fire. Knowing that they're going to be ridiculed, they want to make sure they've got their facts straight. So, you know, it serves a purpose, even though those people are irritating.
The problem is that Bill Nye probably just did a crash course in ufology, and he made so many gaffes and goofs in his performance. For example, this was precious. They were showing purported pictures of UFOs, and they interposed an actual NASA photograph of the Viking lander being packed up many years ago into a crate, and he chose that specific one to choose as the hoax picture. But Larry King and the other people who were on the show didn't pick that up until the next day when I and a couple of other people who were watching brought it to light. So that's what I mean by a debunker. The guy was ignorant. He didn't know the field. He has an honorary PhD for being Mr. Science or something on a kid's show, and they got him on there. But I must say that Seth Shostak was not the same way when he appeared on the Larry King show.
Yeah.
He was uncomfortable because he hasn't studied the field. He made the best defense, but I didn't find him to be aggressive and offensive in the manner that some of those other skeptibunkers.
Skeptibunkers? That's a good word, skeptibunker.
Bunker.
All right. We've only got 3 minutes or so until break. At the top of the hour, I want us to get started on this. You were privileged to get to preview a new movie that's coming out, and I want us to get some of that in before we open up the telephone lines for our audience.
Oh, sure. This. Thank you. I had a wonderful experience yesterday. I was invited to the New York Film Festival, where they aired a film that's coming out. Independent film production is some of the most creative talent that we have in our country, independent of Hollywood and big budgets. Certain groups of people, teams come together, and they produce marvelous work. And Thomas R. Dickens, producer, writer, director of Alien Grey Zone X, won the award, the New York Film Festival Award for science fiction, the genre of science fiction, and presented it's actually the post-production version. Three-quarters of it were presented at the New York Film Festival, as they're still working out the last parts. And it tells the story of a group of people who are out west in a national park, and their vehicles are all sabotaged by electronic means, by UFOs overflying them, to force them on the road so that they then are led in the search of water into a restricted military zone called Zone X. And they go in there looking for a stream because they're dying of dehydration. But I have to say that the UFOs are all over the place. The special effects are really pretty good. What it does count, it's actually a combination. If you cross the story of Area 51 and the Skinwalker Ranch stories by those strange events that are happening out there.
So it's kind of a cross between the two, huh?
Yeah, a cross between the two. Very well done. But captures really the mischievousness and the malice of the Greys. They're shape-shifting, their interdimensional capabilities. Their manipulation of their slow weakening of a human being to manipulate his consciousness and exert mind control, the use of psychic forces to throw humans off balance. So it was really fun. I have to say that as different parts of the film were unfolding, I was taken back to the 1950s science fiction genre, which was always, it was exciting, it was humorous.
All right, we're into a break, and we'll resume in just a couple of minutes here, and we'll open the telephone lines for you, all right? And when we do, the telephone number is 602-539-9580. It's not open yet, but it will be after this break. Don't go away. And welcome back. This is the Kevin Smith Show. Those of you who are joining us just now in the second hour, welcome aboard. We're glad you're here. And we're talking with my guest, Robert Morningstar. And let's see. Let me click a thing or two here, and we'll open up this telephone line for you. The telephone number, if you have a question or a comment for Robert Morningstar, the telephone number is 602-539-9580, 602-539-9580. All right. Let's go to the telephone and caller, you're live on the Kevin Smith Show. Your first name and from where are you calling?
Hello, Kevin. This is Steve Bullwood.
Hi, Steve.
Yes, I have a question for your guest.
Yeah.
When I was a young man, early 60s, I grew up in Florida. My father worked for Pratt & Whitney. And anyway, he was involved with the Apollo program. They built some of the Saturn V rocketry parts. And anyway, we lived out in the country. And anyway, we were big into the Sky and Telescope age, if you remember those days.
Yep.
But we built our own telescope. And anyway, one day I was outside, and it was not uncommon. We lived out in the country, like I said. It was not uncommon for me just to walk out, maybe about 8 or 9 years old, to walk out into a open pasture and to do some telescoping up to the sky. But one day, I looked up, and if you're familiar with the Horsehead Nebula, I had seen it before many times with my tube telescope. This was I don't know if you know what a tube telescope is, but it doesn't have very much power to it. But one day I looked up, and it appeared as though the Horsehead Nebula was like about right in front of me, literally. And it kind of startled me to where I ran in the house afraid. And anyway, I have a... My question is that to, later on during the years, I noticed that I had like a scoop mark on my left leg. And this is not something that you hear about anymore these days. But in the early UFO days, it was pretty common for people to talk about getting scoop marks. And I wonder if this was like an old type of a medical something that maybe the aliens used that they don't use anymore.
Okay, so you did. All right, Steve, did you experience a time loss?
Well, Kevin, like I said, I was about 8 years old, and the thing that was really bizarre about it, now that I think back, like I said, I would walk outside and walk maybe, 200 or 300 yards from my house and go in an open field and look up into the sky with a telescope, and it was by myself, at that age, and I wasn't afraid of anything, but I do recall, I remember telling my dad that, that I saw like big, it looked like meteors, but these meteors were like the size of like an exaggerated fireball. I mean, it was weird. It was like an exaggerated bouncy ball of flames going across the sky. It wasn't just a meteor like you see today. I mean, it was huge, like just going over the sky.
And, all right. Well, let's get Robert's let's get his response to. The scoop marks. You wanted to know if that is a common thing that aliens do to people.
Well, I'd like to know. I mean, I remember reading about it many years ago, but I don't hear anything about it anymore. And I just wonder if that's where that is today.
Okay, what about that, Robert? How common is that today?
Well,
Okay, Kevin, I have to apologize. I didn't want to interrupt your caller. I got about 33% of that, that when he was a child, his father worked for NASA. He was interested in astronomy.
Well, here's the deal. He was out in looking at the sky with his telescope. He was looking at the Horsehead Nebula, and all of a sudden it was right up on him, and it scared him. He ran in the house. And then shortly thereafter found this scoop mark. So what does that sound like to you?
Yes, I did catch the key word, scoop marks. I'm glad that the caller, may I have his name because I don't like to call
him. Yeah, Steve.
If he wants to get, I didn't even hear the name.
Steve.
But this gentleman, yes, I am aware of the scoop mark phenomenon. It is something that I've studied for many years, and I would like to ask him where the scoop mark appeared.
All right. What about that, Steve? Where did the scoop marks appear? Well, that answers that. He is gone. I guess he left us.
Here's the deal.
Yeah.
I've studied the scoop mark phenomena for years. I've seen photographs of the scoop marks from many victims and the locations of these scoop marks. And for me, the flash of light came to me when, this is going to be interesting to you, because this is from the account written by Martin Jasek of the abduction of a Yukon hunter named Kevin.
Okay.
It is probably one of the best written, best researched articles on abduction that I've read, and includes, if you go to ufobc.com, you can find it. Under abductions, involves photographs of scoop marks that this gentleman received, and they were in his palms. And I studied them and scrutinized them and compared them with photographs of other scoop marks that abductees have reported and photographed for decades. And suddenly it hit me in a flash that these scoop marks appear and regions of the body of mostly soft tissue, but in sites where arteries come closest to the surface of the body. So you will find them around the knees and in the area of the femoral artery as it breaks off and branches off into the tibial arteries into the lower leg. In Kevin's case, I went to my Dynamic Anatomy book and started researching the arteries of the hand. And it looked to me like these two needles had been stuck directly into his palm. And they're not, a scoop is not, it looks like a scoop, but when people hear that word, they think that something's come around with a little spoon and just gouged out a little bit of your flesh.
Yeah.
Left a little cup of broken skin there. It actually is the penetration of the skin as the needle enters an artery, and what I believe has happened to these people is that they have been leached of blood. And in the aftermath of these events, the person feels groggy, kind of weak, debilitated, no motivation, wants to sleep, muscles feel weak, can't tell what time of day it is. And it occurred to me, holy mackerel, you know, these are all symptoms of the loss of blood. And it seems to me that this is a big part of this scooping operation, is to draw serum from the human host in the same way that we associate with vampires.
Okay,
so
we
a big element to the activities of these alien abductors.
All right, Robert, we're going to have to move on. We have other calls here.
Okay.
A caller, you are live on the Kevin Smith Show. Your first name and from where are you calling?
Oh, I'm sorry, Kevin. This is Steve. I was calling in again. I had got disconnected somehow.
We were trying to get you back. Where did these scoop marks appear on you?
Well, it's on the very, on my calf, on my left leg. And, it's to this day, I mean, there's no hair to grow on. It's very, for 40 years now, it's been evident. It's never gone away. It's still there.
Okay. Robert, the scoop marks are on the calf on his left leg.
Yeah, well, I mentioned the back of the knee and the branching off of the femoral artery and the popliteal artery No surprise that the hair doesn't grow back anymore because it leaves a scar, and scar tissue doesn't permit the follicles to express the hair.
Mm-hmm.
You did describe being scared, and I think you mentioned, I heard you didn't know what time it was or something. Missing time? Was that part of it?
Did you have missing time, Steve?
Excuse me, Kevin?
Missing time.
You know, I really don't know because I was out in the field by myself, and I mean, it was just so crazy because, I mean, when you look at the Horsehead Nebula with about a 10-power telescope, it's just like very far away. You can barely make out the object. But I mean, this night, I mean, it was like I was 50 miles away. And
okay.
I mean, I was so scared that I went into the house and I just, I don't know. There could have been some.
Does this thing rest upon him?
All right.
As he was watching it and came in.
Yeah, he's the thing about missing time. He just doesn't know. Steve, thanks for the call. We have to move along and allow some other folks in. But thanks much. Very interesting.
Bye.
All right, folks. The telephone number is 602-539-9580. 602-539-9580. All right, let's go back to the phone. Caller, you are live on the Kevin Smith Show. Your first name and where are you calling from?
Hey, this is Chris from Grand Rapids, Michigan.
Yeah, Chris, speak up good and loud for us.
Yes, I just wanted to ask Dr. Morningstar real quick a question, and then I'll listen to the answer offline. The Internet's been kind of a buzz lately with this supposed mass sighting that's to take place October 14th, I believe. I was curious what Dr. Morningstar's views were on that. Now, listen offline. Thank you.
All right, thanks for the call. All right, Robert, what about that? The Internet is abuzz with this story that there's supposed to be a mass sighting October the 14th. What are your thoughts on that?
I've heard about that, and as we reported in February, that one of the demands was of this ET ultimatum, basically it's what it is, the extraterrestrial race that we're discussing gave an ultimatum that either the governments tell the people about UFOs very shortly and get in the process of acclimatizing us to the idea that they are going to be arriving and that we have to have diplomatic contact with them, and that if it wasn't done, there was going to be a manifestation. And we talked about how that was going to affect the prestige of nations if the United States is not the first nation to disclose and bring this to the public consciousness. Another country would be chosen, perhaps one of our adversaries or perhaps one of our neighbors to the south, for mass manifestations of UFOs to put it really basically in the face of the government and the world public, and that this had to be done. And I don't see it having been done or in the way that we expect disclosure to happen. Maybe they're stalling. And I feel that the timetable has been pushed up. So I don't know that this will happen on October 14th. I personally don't believe it myself because I don't have enough information to confirm. Or it's a rumor, basically, that I've heard, as you have heard.
All right, let's go back to the phone line. Okay. Caller, you're live on the Kevin Smith Show. Your first name and from where are you calling?
Kevin, this is Brent from Wyoming.
Hi, Brent.
Hey, Kevin. Robert, I have a question for you. Back about May, first week of May, I had something appeared on my left wrist, the outside of my left wrist on the underside. It was a little black thing about the size of a Tic Tac, maybe a little larger. It itched for a couple weeks, then as the skin grew over it, but I still know exactly where it is. Any opinions what that might be? I don't know if it's an implant or what. I'm just curious.
Are you sure it's not a tick?
No, I'm sure it's not a tick.
All right.
Well, I must excuse myself. I only get about 30%. When a caller calls in, it breaks up a lot, and I don't hear more than 30%. I understand he had a mark on, I believe, his forearm. Can you grab it for me?
Yep. He found a little black mark on the underside of his arm and began to itch, and then the skin grew over it, and he doesn't know what it is.
The body defends itself against invasion in many ways. If something, an object, penetrates the skin, the body goes into a defense mode. Tissue around the foreign object, be that foreign object something that is natural, a piece of glass, a piece of metal that might have penetrated skin in a machine shop, something you stepped on, or an alien implant.
Mm-hmm.
I don't. I didn't hear any referral to a UFO experience happening. This thing apparently just appeared. I would have to see photos of it. I would recommend taking an X-ray of it. The description that he gave of skin growing up around this mark suggests to me that the body went into a defensive mode and is starting to isolate something.
Well, it also indicates that the skin surface had been broken by some means.
There's another thing. There is a thing, a process called keloids, that certain people suffer this. It's not a really, a malady. It's just that the reaction of the body is greater than necessary, and scar tissue will grow and keep growing. It will heal the wound, and the scar tissue will keep growing and turns into raised areas of the body that don't look like skin. They actually look like scar bubbles. Sometimes if it's a long one, a scar will spread out, and that's called a keloid. But again, I would recommend that if you can, have an ultrasound. Ultrasound will reveal an image, by the way. You don't have to get an X-ray, and I prefer ultrasound. They'll run this ultrasound generator over your skin, and the ultrasounds go through you and create an image that can be seen on video to a large extent, like an X-ray. But it's real time. It's right there. You don't have to wait for an X-ray to be developed when you use ultrasound. I had this process. Hello?
Yep.
But I had the process done on me, and my whole body ultrasound analyzed and videotaped about. And quite an experience.
Yeah.
Quite an experience to look inside your own body, to see your organs, your bones. I recommend it to people if you can afford it or if you have a curiosity. It reveals a lot of things. It's a wonderful experience.
Now we
recommend X-rays.
Yeah, X-rays are sometimes necessary, but still, that's radiation.
Yeah.
Now we sort of had to cut it short when we were talking about this new movie because we had callers. Yeah.
Because I tell you, it was very enjoyable, and that's what a movie should be. You should have a good time. There were moments of comedy and moments of tension. The scene where tempers start to flare as these poor people are starting to go into dehydration and the Greys are playing their mischief. The star of this film is a very interesting young actor from Australia, and he's kind of like a cross between Crocodile Dundee and James Dean. I think that's a good description of...
Kind of an independent rebel sort, huh?
David J. Burke,
uh-huh.
Who plays the forest ranger, who comes upon these people and then becomes a leader to try to find the stream. And he's quite an accomplished martial artist, and the movie has elements of spirituality. Meditative development of chi, for example, is depicted in special effects. And he has to tangle with some pretty wild creatures. And some of the scenes reminded me of the Incredible Shrinking Man and his fight against the spider And then some of the fights that are had and contention with the Greys as they snatch people from this party as they become weaker and weaker and lag behind, the Greys start coming in and harassing them.
All right, let's talk about that for just a minute now.
I think these people did a wonderful effort. The special effects are very good, and they actually depict the movements of the black triangles, the black triangle UFOs, very well.
All right, I want to get into this a little bit because, well, you know, back in the 1950s and later, most of the UFO extraterrestrial sci-fi that came out sort of depicted the extraterrestrials as maybe not too benevolent toward us, and some of them depicted the extraterrestrials as being very benevolent. But I mean, for instance, you had War of the Worlds, the movie version that came out. And then you had all kinds of, you know, the thing from Planet Zagon or something like that. And all kinds of those where the extraterrestrials were hostile to us. Then we went into a phase where most of the sci-fi stuff showed the extraterrestrials as being, if not benevolent, at least not hostile. And then we went into the Star Wars phase where we had both.
I think the Star Wars part is probably the closest to the truth, and that there are many races of extraterrestrials, and that they do contend for territories and spheres of influence. And it seems to me that the Earth has been divided up for different kinds of ET operations, but they encroach upon each other's spheres of influence, and that's when they tangle. Like this purported UFO fight over Kelowna Lake in Canada, I believe it's in British Columbia, happened earlier in the year over a lake. Two different types of UFO crafts engaged, and one got blasted. And the Russians have reported seeing UFO fights. I think if you saw the UFO files dealing with Russian UFO events, including their interactions with MiG interceptors and MiGs flying through what the Russians take to be proton beams, that kind of yanked on the wing and made it glow. Plus, Russian, that famous crash site that was shown on the UFO files purportedly was the crash of a craft that had been engaged by another kind of craft and shot down. So there is war in the skies between contending races of aliens. The Greys are one group, and we know what their activities are now, thanks to Whitley Strieber, who revealed his work, his experiences in communion, and then opened up the floodgates, really, because people who were previously afraid to describe these harrowing experiences with really strange beings started to come forth and avow their experiences and acknowledge them publicly. But there's another race, or several other races. One of them is the tall whites, or so-called Nordics, who are more human. They have human bodies, but seem to be very fearsome warriors, according to the stories of Charles Hall and others. Encounters with a tall white can be very frightening, extremely powerful,
well,
a lot of psychic energy. And then the element of the paranormal, UFO event, according to science, has to be classified paranormal because there's no explanation in Newtonian science.
Okay, Robert, we've got to take a break. We'll be back, okay, folks, right after this. And I got a big question for Robert. Big question about a big UFO event if it happens. We'll be back right after this. Welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. I'm Kevin Smith, your host, and we're talking with Robert Morningstar. I got a big question for you, Robert.
Okay.
We were talking about, you were talking about all the various different races that of extraterrestrials. And, you know, I had talked about the movies. We went through a phase where it was they were all going to be hostile to us, and then we went through a phase where it's all going to be peace, love, and light. And then we got to the Star Wars phase where it's both. We've been hearing, you know, we started out tonight pretty quickly. We talked about the information about this UN meeting that took place back in February. The, for those who aren't familiar with it, very quickly, meeting that took place in the UN building apparently was about UFO disclosure, and the message was that it's got to happen, disclosure's got to happen, because extraterrestrials are going to show up pretty soon, unambiguously, and everyone's going to know, so we've got to start getting the public used to this. All right, that being the case, Let's assume that all of that is absolute, set in stone, concrete, and true. And there's going to be this unambiguous arrival of extraterrestrial group is coming. The good guys or the bad guys?
Well, yeah, it's kind of blunt. The bad guys are very happy with the situation. And by the bad guys, we love the grays and the wonderful things that they're doing for us and enlightening us and elevating our consciousness and warning us about how bad we are with the world and the earth. And I'm sorry, but I do not approve of abduction, kidnapping, rape, and abortion, which in straight terms is what has been going on. In no uncertain terms, I'm not mincing any words, these things. Snatched somebody, abducted them, held them for unknown periods of time, conducted unethical medical procedures, implants, and then comes back and take it. That is a whole laundry list of really criminal acts. And I would not condone that in a human being, and I will not condone that in anything that does that to human beings.
Okay, but now we have a caller online, so we can't take long with this, but which group is coming?
Well, I would describe them as whites. The tall whites are a very interesting group of extraterrestrials. They have the ability to morph themselves in your mind, I'll put it that way, because they find that it's easier to interact with human beings by appearing to them in a form that is not so alien. And so when these whites appear to people, they don't know that they're having an extraterrestrial experience.
Okay, so you think that's who's coming?
A ghost experience.
So you say that those are the ones that are coming to appear unambiguously to us?
That is what I've been told. They are able to sustain an image. They can actually create an image that's very, very human-looking in the person's mind's eye.
Okay, let's go to the telephone.
It takes a lot of energy to maintain this, and it starts to dissolve after 45 minutes or 50 minutes, and they kind of dissolve into a white Pillsbury Doughboy. What can I tell you?
Okay. Let's go to the telephone, and okay, Robert, we have to go to the telephone. Robert, we got to go to the telephone. We got a caller on. Okay, caller, you are live on the Kevin Smith Show. Your first name and where are you calling from?
Yeah, this is Trey in Atlanta.
Hi, Trey in Atlanta.
Hello, guys. Robert, thanks for coming on. I got a couple of times. Here we're talking about missing time, and the missing time that's a tricky thing because you've actually got to be able to have something to measure it against, whereas, you know, your parents are worried about you, you're late for dinner, you're driving a route that you know is going to take X amount of time, you know you left at a certain time, but if you're wandering around outside in a field, messing around maybe in the woods, well, you can always think, well, I could have lost track of time and didn't know, but I was going to mention that. And I was going to ask you if I could get, I don't mean to be rude, but if I can get a yes or no answer, and then I've got a real quick follow-up question. It won't be long.
Have you ever read any transcripts or studied any stories of people that are telling as they're being hypnotically regressed?
I've read many stories, transcripts of people who are hypnotically regressed and different things that they have described. Yes, I have read things like that. If you're talking about specifically with extraterrestrials, yes, I read that. I've read other things that people described that I said as ghosts.
Okay, Kevin, could you tell me what he said?
He said yes.
Yes, okay. Let me ask you this. I'm going to describe something to you and tell me if you have ever heard this scenario.
Okay,
at least this,
go ahead.
This is what I call it, the waiting room. Have you ever heard anyone describe being in a room and there's humans walking around quickly or running around quickly, frantically, looking like they're trying to figure out where the heck they are, and they're all being followed by another human, at least it looks like, and all these humans are always smaller humans. And basically, it doesn't really matter what the room looks like. Close is a room with humans running around frantically, don't know where they are, and they've always got a smaller human with them. Have you ever heard anything resembling that?
Yes, I have. I have heard descriptions of people being held in rooms where both extraterrestrials and other humans are assisting them. Yes, it's a very commonly reported experience. So it shows that some humans or ET human hybrids have now been trained to assist the gray in these operations. If you would read Dr. David M. Jacobs, The Threat, he goes into detail about the hybrids, because he's looking upon it over 60 years of time, and it seems that the hybriding program of the 1950s and 60s evolved into creating a creature and evolving that creature, combination of ET and human, so that it can, it has now advanced to the stage where they can interact with us and be almost indistinguishable from other human beings when they're dressed appropriately. It's interesting that Dr. Jacobs describes repeated incidences of hybrids, particularly in the Midwest, who dress in a particular style, have a pretty kind of violent bent to their attitude and their behavior, and they are apparently facilitators to lure and to abduct women for these ongoing experiments, extraction of ova, fertilization, implantation, removal, and so on. And they also have a very disturbing attribute in that they are very menacing, and the women are often afraid to come forth for fear of being abused and beaten. Heavy-handed thuggery, what I've heard described. And if you read Dr. Jacob's book, The Threat, and you'll get a lot of information on this.
All right, does that answer your question, Trey?
Yeah, I would say, I think David Jacobs is right about a lot of stuff for sure. And some of it goes with what the Bible says about us being tricked into fighting against God. But I will say this, that I always called it the waiting room and waiting to see the doctor. And I call my guy Dr. Lizard Man.
That's a very good phrase you use, the waiting room.
Yeah. All right, Trey, thanks for the call, man.
What it is.
Thanks for taking
my call.
All right, thanks for the call.
Pleasure.
Ladies and gentlemen, the telephone line is open for you. It is 602-539-9580. 602-539-9580. If you have a question or a comment for Robert Morningstar, now keep in mind that not only has he been a UFO researcher for many, many years, he is the editor of UFO Digest, and so a whole lot of information comes across his desk. As editor, I'm sure some of it doesn't make it to publication, but he gets to see lots and lots and lots and lots of information. So it may be that you have had some sort of a strange experience that you think may be of extraterrestrial origin. He may know something about that, may have heard something similar or read something about a similar situation. And so he would be a good resource for you to comment or to ask a question. Robert,
Kevin, I'd like to say a few words about the network of people and researchers and colleagues that I developed. You're included in that, of course. A lot comes across my desk. Not all of it makes it to UFO Digest, but I work closely with other researchers like Joe Fassenda in UFO Scotland, Peter Celebius in Poland, and Giuliano Markovic in Europe. So all of us network, and as I like to say, cross-pollination of information. And with the sharing of knowledge, we coalesce our forces, and I do enhancements. For example, there are some very interesting photos put out on at UFO Scotland, UFORS.com. That came from the Glasgow area, and Joe sent them to me for enhancement, and what resulted was the appearance of spindle-shaped forms above and below this digital craft in the digital photograph.
Yeah, you sent me that in an email. Very interesting photo.
Right. The real skill in computer graphics is enhancing a photo by not tampering with it in the sense like Photoshop. I work with changing the contrast, the brightness, the gamma level, and the sharpness. Mm-hmm. And occasionally an effect like swapping red for blue when you have color photographs will also bring into view hidden characteristics of a craft.
And you know, so also I've noticed
looking at these photos, and I'd like to thank Carl Foster in the UK, in England, who has been sending me photos for the last few months. Some people have a skill, and it's really basically an instinct or an intuition. They go out with a camera and they get a feeling and just take a picture, and it's almost as if they're getting the message to take a picture for the purpose of the UFO appearing later when the image is retrieved from memory. Because this is happening primarily, the phenomenon is with digital cameras. And the digital camera appears to pick up frequencies that the human eye cannot see. So it's a very fascinating phenomenon to hear this over and over. I didn't see anything. Something told me to take the picture. I just thought it was a nice picture. When I got home, I saw the UFO.
All right, we're into a break, and we'll be back after this with more from Robert Morningstar and your telephone calls. Don't go away. And we are back. We're talking with Robert Morningstar, and we're a wide-ranging discussion about many, many topics. And you have the opportunity to share in the conversation by calling 602-539-9580. Before we go back to our conversation with Robert Morningstar, let me tell you that tomorrow night my guest will be Jerry Wills. Now, Jerry is an explorer and a lot of things, but he is an explorer for sure, and he is in Peru, and we have scheduled him to be with us tomorrow night from Peru. We are going to try to bring you video of Jerry, live video of Jerry during the show as we talk with him from Peru. We're going to try. I don't guarantee that it's going to work. We've never tried that before, but we're going to try. So you want to be sure and tell all your friends, tell all your enemies, everyone you know that you don't like, and they hate UFO stuff and they hate paranormal stuff, be sure you recommend our show to them. All right. Now, back to Robert Morningstar. Robert, I want to ask you something before we get too far down the road here, and before I forget this. You made reference to tectonic waves.
Yes.
And you said that you thought that it is quite possible that the atomic tests that were done back during the 50s and 60s set up some tectonic waves. Tell us what you're talking about with that.
Okay, the blast creates devastation in the local area. If you look at some of the underground blasts that occurred in Nevada and Utah in the 1950s, aerial photographs or actually films of them, you'll see the blast wave goes out, lifts the earth, and then there's a huge depression. It sinks into itself. And in that uplifting of vast tons of earth and rock, and the sinking under the force of gravity, a second wave is created, and that wave continues to propagate downward. Just think of hitting a drum, beating a drum.
Would they not have dissipated by now?
Well, I think that they start to interfere and resonate with each other. The most recent example, and believe me, I foretold the tsunami years ago, and I foretold it when the French blasted 8 nuclear bombs under near Mororoa. You remember when all the Tahitian people accosted the French French troops and beat the hell out of them? That was an amazing thing to see, and rightly so. They were outraged that France, in 1994 or 95, had detonated 8 nuclear weapons tests under the sea in Mororoa. And you look at where Mororoa is, and you look where the tsunami happened, and I believe that the cascade of forces, the submarine, the submarine layer of the mantle, was put into motion, but that these forces take many, many years to propagate and to unsettle the magma and the mantle. And I believe that that is one of the examples of this event. So think of the thousands of nuclear weapons that have been tested, both by Russia, well, not both, it's Russia, the United States, France, Britain, Canada, South Africa. I include the Canadians in our own atomic testing as cohorts. It was necessary to develop them based on the strategic theories of defense of the 1950s and 60s and mutual assured destruction. South Africa and one Middle Eastern country, which we all know, all have tested nuclear weapons in the sea and underground, and we were doing it in outer space too, and that might have attracted a lot of attention back in the late 50s and 60s. Those are some of the most amazing films you'll ever see. They're very rare, but of nuclear explosions in outer space.
I want to ask you about that. You say that we have tested nuclear weapons in outer space.
Yes, that's what led to the test ban treaties that Kennedy initiated, and that is what forced all the underground testing. The atmospheric testing was seen to be obviously so dangerous. I don't know if people remember, but in the 1950s test, the black rain was discovered when we did some tests in the Pacific, and the radiation went up into the stratosphere and was carried by winds that then took the radioactive dust and precipitated into a rain that fell on Japanese fishing trawlers, and the men were bathed in the black rains, and this happened quite commonly. And the problem was that you might test it in one region, but it was unpredictable where the fallout would come. So Kennedy negotiated with the Russians no more atmospheric nuclear testing. And so that relegated the testing to underground tests. As a matter of fact, I have read of one plan that was used to deal with nuclear waste, which involved detonating atom bombs deep within the earth in Nevada and Utah. And when these detonations occurred, a cave was formed, a vitrified material, a spherical cave, a glass cave was formed underground. And into these containers, as they used them, a lot of radioactive waste was poured. It was a quick fix to the problem of nuclear material that was being produced by the reactors that we have, toxic nuclear waste. So they blew a small atom bomb deep under the earth, created a chamber, and poured the stuff down. So this is the kind of thing I'm saying, that over 60 years of time, huge forces were released. Imagine eight of these by the French in a very short span of time detonated in the South Pacific. What they did to submarine life.
Robert, we're just about out of time. We've got maybe a minute left. Okay, Robert, we have maybe 1 minute left. In that 1 minute, would you like to give us a web address for people to check out?
Oh, sure. First of all, foremost, of course, UFODigest.com. And I'd like to give the web address for the Alien Gray Zone X film that I was discussing.
Yeah, go ahead.
AGZ-X.com. That's capital AGZ-X.com. And you'll have a lot of fun. There's a nice a fun trailer there that gives you the basic story and the plot line. You see the characters. And I met David Burke. I'm having lunch with him tomorrow to discuss the film and the post-production with him, and to exchange more information. He's a very interesting fellow.
Robert, we've reached the end of the show. Thanks for being with us. If you will, stay online with me for just a moment. Ladies and gentlemen, that's it for this evening. Thanks for being here. We've got a great show again tomorrow night, and you want to be here for that too. My friends call me Steel Eye. My enemies do too, and you can call me whatever you want. Just keep coming back again and again and again. Until tomorrow, so long, everybody.